Good morning. The open meeting for this Thursday, November 2nd, 2023 will now come to order. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have a special motion.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the commission may consider the submission of the late submission of agenda document number 23-23-B.
Any discussion of the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Motion passes unanimously. And before we get started on our agenda, I'm passing it to Commissioner Traynor for a point of personal privilege.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This morning, I would like to congratulate my hometown Texas Rangers on having won the World Series yesterday, the first time in the history, and also the first team to not lose a road game in a series. So congratulations to the Texas Rangers.
Congratulations to you and your team. The first item on the agenda is the proposed directive regarding investigations conducted by the Office of General Counsel. So Commissioner Dickerson, I will pass the mic to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me first start by congratulating Commissioner Traynor on behalf of Mets fans everywhere. Congratulations. Don't get used to it. So I have a cover memorandum, which I think speaks for itself, but I wanted to note a few general points. First is that the statute that we administer, the Federal Election Campaign Act, entrusts the, quote, conduct of investigations to the commission. And it explicitly makes that a four-vote matter requiring commission supervision. This directive began as a bipartisan effort with Commissioner Broussard, and I don't want to speak for her, but I think that we both recognized that where errors or omissions occur at the commission, whether in the investigations or otherwise, that responsibility lies with the commissioners and not with the Office of General Counsel or with staff. This is intended to create a mechanism to discharge the commission's oversight responsibilities and to ensure commissioner accountability for the conduct of our investigation. And with that table setting, Madam Chair, I look forward to the vote.
Commissioner Broussard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a cold, so sorry, it sounds really bad at times. But I too want to note that this was a bipartisan effort. And as usual, I've enjoyed working with Commissioner Dickerson on this. But I presented an alternative draft that I'd just like to put a few words out. For the consideration today, I submit Agenda Document B, which is an alternative proposed directive regarding the Office of General Counsel's investigations. I agree with the words of my colleague that we as the commission are responsible for the investigations that we've done. And so where there may be lacks or where there may have been failures, we also accept that responsibility. This is designed to address the specific proposals that had the potential at times that I believe the original draft would have had some delays and further burdens with OGC's work. But the effort here is to preserve the independence that the Office of General Counsel needs to follow an investigation leads that either strengthen the case for probable cause against respondents or absolve those respondents of the allegations. But it acknowledges the need for change when the average length of investigations have stretched well beyond a year, dating back to fiscal year 2017, including a high of 826 days, in fiscal year 2022, and most recently, 437 days in fiscal year 2023. I want to thank my colleagues for working with me on this, but I speak, and I oftentimes say this, but it's true, is that I speak with a unique perspective. Because of the six individuals that serve as commissioners, I was the one that's present with us today, or present in Zoom world, that served as a staff attorney in the Office of General Counsel and have experience with these investigations. And while this alone doesn't make me more qualified to speak on investigation process than any of my other colleagues, it is the unique experience that I have, and I can provide some context. Investigations can move at a deliberate pace, but they can also be frustrated by the inherently bureaucratic nature of FICA. Draft B would delay the adoption of the investigation plan until after the respondents have had an opportunity to reply to the commission's reasonably findings. And I believe this eliminates some of the need for the commission, for OGC to have to return to the commission for the approval of endless rounds of an investigative plan. Additionally, and I find this very important, footnote number 5 At paragraph 5, includes a footnote that the identification of new sources of publicly available information is not an expansion of the scope of the investigation, requiring an investigative plan or an additional tally vote, because this reflects a long-held practice by OGC to consult and consider common sources of publicly available information, including official records from other government agency and news sources. The footnote also requires that such new sources of information be included in regular updates. And finally, draft B sunsets the proposed directive in on June the 30th of 2025 instead of December 31st of 2025. I believe that that earlier date provides enough time for the Commission, the Office of General Counsel, and other stakeholders to assess the effectiveness of the procedures with time for permanent adoption or to implement any necessary changes by the year end. In closing, I've spent the majority of my career with this agency, and I care deeply about the statutory responsibility and equally about the morale and job satisfaction of each FEC employee. But I do believe that this draft improves upon the original proposal by balancing the OGC's independence with the Commission's responsibility to oversee investigations. And I respectfully urge my colleagues to support at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to highlight one part of the investigation plan that I think is particularly important and that should speed up our investigations. And I hope to send a message to the regulated community that the Office of General Counsel has the full backing of the Commission in whatever investigation it's conducting. There is no benefit to gamesmanship and attempting to play OGC against the Commission here. And undue delays are not tolerated because the Commission has already authorized OGC to conduct the investigation and approved its tactics and plans. In the cases in which the Commission authorizes a subpoena, that means that we are willing to go to federal court to enforce that subpoena if need be. And while I've advocated to allow for a voluntary compliance period, and I'll discuss that in a second, the message will be clear that OGC is always acting with the full weight and authority of the Commission. If you want to cooperate voluntarily, that's wonderful. But voluntary compliance is not an opportunity to delay the investigation. Currently, we see respondents that are often just delaying complying with requests from our counsel. And this should bring an end to that. As for the two-week voluntary compliance period ahead of the subpoenas, I am acutely aware of the impacts of Commission actions, including investigations of enforcement matters and how they have an effect on individuals, candidates, committees, and vendors that are either the target or subject of that information or have relevant information to the investigations. For those vendors or other entities that routinely work in the political realm but are not the target, receiving a subpoena from the Commission is a reputational risk, even if they've done nothing wrong. Providing the opportunity for voluntary compliance with the Commission's discovery request before serving a subpoena will allow those not the target or subject of the investigation the opportunity to avoid a formal subpoena if they wish. On the flip side, for the target and the subject of Commission investigations, this change will convey that any voluntary compliance is a privilege and not a right. Should they delay in complying with OGC's discovery request, they will know that a subpoena has been authorized and is ready to serve. This change will preserve the upside of voluntary compliance, where it's engaged in good faith, but reduces the downside risk that a target or subject uses voluntary discovery as a method to delay and obstruct a Commission investigation. So I am looking forward to these investigations going faster and getting to us on an expedited basis. Any further comments? Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And my sincere thanks to Commissioner Dickerson, Commissioner Broussard, and the chair for all the work that went into putting this policy together that I think is going to get adopted today. And I think that is commendable. I agree with certainly the spirit of it. And I think much of its provisions. I'm not going to be able to support draft B today because of one issue, and I just want to articulate why. So when I vote no, it's not misinterpreted. I think I agree with pretty much everything in it, but I think commissioners have a longstanding disagreement about the issue of investigations and the use of publicly available information and news sources by the Office of General Counsel as part of its conduct and its assessment of enforcement matters. You know, in my view, those parts of investigation should be subject to the same kind of commission approval as other forms of compulsory process for an important reason, which is that we've seen in many instances that the exploration, the investigation of publicly available information has led to long amounts of effort and time wasted or spent on these things, I think often fruitlessly. And I think that demands a greater degree of commission oversight. And frankly, I think there are different tolerances among commissioners about what constitutes permissible or acceptable investigations of publicly available information. And, you know, more importantly, I should say that while this is a policy that is focused on authorized investigations by the commission after it has found reason to believe, my greater concern is that by blessing it in this stage of the enforcement process, we are further entrenching it at a stage in which it is, I think, much more problematic, which is before finding reason to believe in drafting the FGCRs, when we have instances in which attorneys are reading entire books, going through entire libraries and resources, spending thousands, literally thousands of hours on outside research to write an FGCR to get information that postdates the complaint. I think that is a problem with our investigations, and that is something that I want to rein in and not further entrench. And so, for that reason, I'm not able to support a policy that includes that footnote. But I do very much agree with the rest of it, and I agree that ultimately the commission needs to own these investigations and exercise a certain degree, greater degree of control and oversight of them. So again, with my sincere thanks to everyone who worked on it, that's all.
Any further discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Broussard, well, like all of us, we each bring our own unique set of experiences to the table. And my views are informed by years of watching commissioners try and influence investigations. And I don't want anything that I say to be construed as a personal comment about anybody sitting at the table, because as I said, it's my views are informed by years of seeing how commissioner involvement in investigations has turned out. And lest the public be confused by some of the statements that have been made earlier about and think that we have a bunch of government employees running amok and running rampant through investigations. To provide a little bit of context, there are currently roughly, I think, 200 cases in our enforcement division and exactly 7 ongoing investigations, 7 active investigations. So not a lot of investigatory activity actually going on. And I can recall any number of cases where I have implored my colleagues, you know, we could resolve this matter with a very targeted investigation with 3 questions, 1 question even, and getting being unsuccessful in persuading the required 3 other commissioners to agree to ask a very limited number of questions. Both of these policies reflect a trend that's been going on for many years. It's not unique to recent times of commissioners trying to be to frankly micromanage the few investigations that we do. And I appreciate all the efforts that went into this. I know people spent a lot of time on this. And I absolutely agree that the commissioners are responsible for the conduct of the investigations and what goes on in the agency. I believe that means we should ensure that our staff have the appropriate resources and training personnel to conduct the business in an efficient and effective and professional manner. I have a lot of confidence in our staff. I think we have a lot of great attorneys who work in this building. I think it is, I'm not aware of any other investigatory agencies, any other law enforcement agencies, and that is indeed what we are, where the political appointees at the very top of the agency literally go over every single question that is asked. And that is what would happen under either of these policies. And let me say that I agree that draft B is a big improvement over earlier drafts. And there are a number of provisions in there that I agree with and that I could support. But I think the crux of both of these policies is to ensure that commissioners will be micromanaging every single investigation, that the staff will require commissioners' permission to ask every single question. And I think, particularly given the political sensitivity of some of the investigations that we do, all the investigations that we do, having political appointees making all of those decisions is not ideal and certainly not typical of how other law enforcement agencies work. So although, as I said, I appreciate all the efforts that went into it, and I appreciate the as I said, there are a number of provisions, particularly in draft B, that I would agree with. I am not going to be able to support either of these drafts.
Any further discussion? Okay. Any motions or discussion? Motion. All right. Motions. Commissioner Dickerson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the adoption of Agenda Document 23-21-B. Which is draft B.
Any discussion of the matter?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just one very brief point. I share the Vice Chairman's concerns on review of publicly available information, and I will be watching OGC very closely and how it interprets this. But I do think it bears note that this is intended as a solely post-RTB investigatory policy that should not be interpreted, at least in my view, to impact activity that occurs prior to a finding of reason to believe.
Any further discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
No.
The motion passes 4-2 with Commissioner Dickerson, Trainer, Broussard, and myself in favor. The Vice Chair and Commissioner Weintraub opposed. Thank you all. Glad to move forward on this one. All right, next up, we have advisory opinion. What number is this? Advisory opinion 2023-06. Council, would you like to come on up? Advisory opinion was requested by Texas Majority PAC, and we have Jonathan Burkon and Courtney Weissman and Sarah Mahmood is here on behalf of the requester. And the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, Commissioner.
I've been there. Trust me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioners. Before you are agenda documents 2023-23A and 2023-23B, which are draft responses to an advisory opinion request from Texas Majority PAC. The requester asks whether costs associated with its proposed paid canvas would constitute in-kind contributions to any federal candidate or political party committee depicted in the referenced canvassing materials. Draft A concludes that the proposed paid canvas would not include coordinated communications. However, the canvassing expenses would include coordinated expenditures, the cost of which would be in-kind contributions to the federal candidates or political party committees depicted or referenced in the canvassing materials. Draft B concludes that the paid canvas would include coordinated communications. Accordingly, the cost of the communications would be in-kind contributions to any federal candidate or political party committee that's depicted in the communication. The commission received one comment on the request and four comments on the drafts. Thank you. We're available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. And we have quite a few comments, as you said, that have come in through the last 2 days. So maybe 24 hours. Colleagues, any questions, discussion? Yes.
Madam Chair. Thank you. A preliminary question, and then I'll step aside from my colleagues. So I read your original request as being principally about whether this activity would be a coordinated communication. There was then some back and forth. I appreciated your citation to Martin versus the City of Struthers. I enjoyed that. But some back and forth on whether 109.20B, the coordinated expenditure regulation, was implicated. And there's been quite a number of comments, which I generally found persuasive about that question. But my question is one of jurisdiction. You know, we can only answer the questions that you ask us. And so I want to ask you directly, are you asking us to opine on 109.20B, or is your request limited to coordinated communications analysis?
I think our question, well, I guess I'll answer it in two parts. I think our question is whether or not the paid canvas is a contribution. So I do think that question, to the extent the commission believes that 109.20B applies, I think it is part of your jurisdiction to answer. Ultimately, I think it's our view that 109.20B does not apply to the paid canvas, but I don't think it's outside your jurisdiction to answer that question.
So follow up then, would you consider an answer that does not opine on 109.20B to be a complete answer to your question, or is that now squarely presented by your AOR?
Yeah, I mean, so I think this process has been a bit, I think, as you indicated, Commissioner, a bit unusual insofar as, you know, we asked a question, we got back, I think, very helpful follow-up questions. We responded. I think part of the reason why we suggest an extension might be appropriate here is perhaps to reframe pieces of the question, at least insofar as the expenses are concerned. Because in reading draft A, to the extent that draft A is the framework that forms the basis of the future, the ultimate opinion, we are having difficulty discerning which expenses as part of the paid canvas would be considered non-communication expenditures versus communication expenditures. So to the extent that it would be useful at some point for us to, you know, perhaps reframe as part of an extension, I think we're happy to do that and hopefully use this meeting as an opportunity to narrow the questions that are actually before the commission and provide any additional factual information that might be useful.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And thanks to OGC for the presentation. To follow up on what you just said, I mean, you said, well, let me back up and say, I your comments that we received yesterday were helpful. I wish they had been the basis of the original request and I'd had more time to consider them than 24 hours. But am I right when I read at the bottom of page 2, your statement, draft A's proposed analytical framework is consistent with the second pillar. You have a preceding discussion of the two pillars. To ask whether expenses are, quote, for canvassing communications themselves, end quote, or are, quote, sufficiently direct inputs or components of the canvassing communications to be considered part of the communication. Do you agree that's the standard?
So I think to Commissioner, to your earlier question, part of the reason that it was not the basis for original opinion is that we did not anticipate that would be the standard to apply. coming into it. So I think this is the, and I think in looking back at the original follow-up question that came in regarding 10920B, I think we, and I think it's not just the requesters here, but I think as you saw in the comments from the regulated community, we have historically viewed this issue as a question of whether the 10921 or 10920 applies. And in some sense, it's really a two-part question. The first question is a paid canvas a public communication or not? And then once you get past that point, then I think our position is that 10921 is the governing regulation. I think draft A introduced, and I have a sense of obviously where it's coming from. I think though there's no citation, it appears to be coming from the court's decisions in the Correct the Record case. I think it is absolutely fair that that is part of the standard and part of the question that is asked. I think in terms of applying it, we don't think it applies to these particular costs, but I think it is an entirely reasonable question to ask as part of the analysis, because there could be expenditures that in fact fail that test and therefore would not be considered part of the communication cost. I think as applied in the original draft A, it would subsume so many of core communication costs, including distribution costs, as to make it virtually impossible to actually have a communication that fits within 109.21. But we don't object to that question being asked.
So I guess, well, let me back up to a bit of a higher level and make sure I'm understanding your theory, which I think is also what's set out in draft A, your theory of the interplay between 10920B and 10921. So sorry to go back to the first principles here. So 10921 covers coordinated communications, which, you know, it was limited to public communications for this discussion. We'll just say that. And then we have 10920B, which is non-communication expenditures, coordinated non-communication expenditures. And you know, you might think of it as there's a gap between those things, which we'll call them non-public communications, right? These are things like you're proposing, like a canvas, internet communications, right, would be the most obvious ones, which are explicitly said not to be public communications. You know, we'll get other AO requests about asking whether a particular, you know, rallies or other things are non-public communications. And for those things, the cost for those are not covered by 10921 or 10920B, 10920B. They can be coordinated, and the costs for them are not in-kind contributions insofar as the expenses for them are for the communications themselves or for sufficiently direct inputs of those communications. That is your theory of how those provisions interplay with each other.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And you, I heard you, but I want to make clear, you know, you're right that it's very similar language from the Correct the Record opinion, but that's you're fine with that standard for what is covered in that gap of exempted non-public communications, what costs are considered not to be in-kind contributions.
Correct.
Okay. Do you then disagree with Sandler Reef's comment that the standard is bizarre and illogical?
I think as applied, I agree with the outcome of what they're saying, that as applied, it would result in that. But you saw my comments and I did not use those words.
Okay. So then, you know, this isn't that it's an accusation, but you said you were having trouble figuring out how that standard of expenses for the communications or sufficiently direct inputs would apply. I mean, no offense, isn't that part of your fault because you didn't really give us a list of the expenses that were covered by this?
Absolutely. No, I think that is entirely fair. And to my earlier point, I think when you understand the framework that will be used to answer a question, it helps you frame a request to get the answers on the things that you're asking about. Again, I think because this standard had not been, setting aside and Correct the Record, it had not been articulated, at least by this commission beforehand, the itemization piece of it, the fact that we would be going item by item, was not how I anticipated the commission would answer the question, frankly, until we saw draft A. So absolutely. I mean, ultimately, this is an interplay between the requester and the commission. And when you hit kind of upon a novel issue like that, I think that's why we thought a pause might make some sense to to try it now that we have a sense of where you are coming from, if there's additional information we can provide. But ultimately, you are right.
Can I just jump in just so we can clarify that? We haven't asked you for an extension, but are you, without our asking, telling us that you were granted? Okay. All right. Yeah.
Well, let me, I just have a few more questions, I guess, about the expenses that were described in the request, not everything. So, and how it interplays with the standard. So, you know, the AO request says that the canvassers, quote, will be instructed to go to homes of pre-selected voters. How is that determined, who the pre-selected voters are?
Yeah, and that was a question that came up in one of the earlier back and forth. So that will be a determination made by our client, that they will determine who the pre-selected voters are. They will do the targeting themselves.
So are they going to come up with their own list based on existing resources? Yeah,
exactly. I mean, they have access to voter file data and do their data analysis, and will come up with that.
And that's all done in-house?
That's done in-house.
By lists or anything like that, voter profiles or anything?
Exactly.
Okay. And then the AO request also says that canvassers, quote, will record the voters' answers to certain questions. I think that, you know, there's a couple questions that arise from that. One is sort of, what are you going to do with the, what are they planning to do with the answers, right? This goes to your point. This raises, in your comments, you talk about one of the, as you're describing, well, sort of the reasoning of correct the record, right? That one of the things the court was looking at was whether the expenses could be used for, to build something that has a non-communication purpose, a separate purpose. It would seem that administering a questionnaire, building, you know, voter profiles for future purposes might fit within that, as in we're doing a canvas, but we're also building voter profiles, we're collecting data. So I don't know, what is your response to that?
So I would analytically break it into two pieces. I don't think that the asking of questions and recording of answers in and of itself falls under 10920B. I think that is part of the communication. The communication is a conversation, and essentially recording the information from that conversation, in my view, is part of the communication because it directly relates to it and records it. To the extent then that our client were to turn the, from that information, you can create all sorts of voter profiles and data. You might record that information, you know, in the voter file as you're, they're taking information. To the extent that our client then turned that information over to a candidate, that's where I think 10920B would come in, right? I mean, and that's why I think analytically, that's where the interplay kind of takes its full force there. Once that information would be turned over to the candidate, to me at that point, then that would be an in-kind. So if that were to happen, there would have to be some kind of payment to avoid an in-kind contribution. But the mere act of recording that information, let's use an example where they didn't turn it over to the candidate, it just stayed with the committee. I don't see where the benefit then goes to the candidate such that that would be an in-kind contribution.
Well, the last one is, you know, there's a lot of discussion of the issue of the staff time, right? And your discussion of production versus distribution and that distinction. I want to differentiate between maybe the canvassers themselves, so literally people going door to door, and say, you know, the vendor, the managers, the recruiters, the people in the back office, right? The thing that strikes me that's going to be a problem to the extent that we're operating in a correct the record framework is that, you know, staff time was one of the specific things that the court said was not a sufficiently direct input to the communications. So how is that going to get squared if a lot of what is being spent here for these vendors is hiring people to do the trainings, to recruit people, to write the questions, to write the literature, to design it, and how is that going to get squared?
Yeah, and so I think part of, I mean, in reading draft A, I noticed that the compensation of the canvassers was not one of the things that was deemed to be a non-communication expenditure. It also was not deemed explicitly to be a communication expenditure, and if I can assume for a second that the compensation of canvassers would be deemed to be a communication expenditure in draft A, we are then left with something, I guess, that goes right above it, which is the hiring of those canvassers, the training of those canvassers, and the managing of those canvassers. And I think the distinction between that time and Correct the Record is that the time there is to ensure that the communications, the specific communications themselves, get distributed to the voters in a effective and efficient way. So you can't obviously have the canvassers in this case are the delivery mechanism, and that really wasn't the case in Correct the Record. You could have a staffer, you know, in the more of the Correct the Record situation. Again, I'm not weighing in on the on the merits of that case, but there was no there. The staffer could do a lot of other different types of work that could be repurposed for a non-exempt purpose. Whereas here, ultimately, the only role that the canvasser plays is to deliver the two canvassing communications, the first of which is the piece of literature, the second of which is the script itself. There's no other, if there's no other utility for their time, their work, and therefore the payment for it. The time that is spent to then hire those folks, I think, falls into the same category, because again, the hiring is directly connected to actually having canvassers to then pay. And the time and money that is spent to hire those folks, there's no ability to repurpose that. It's not like you get a hiring agency that you can then use to hire the rest of your staff. You pay them for that specific purpose, then they go away. It's directly tied to the distribution of it. And I view it the same way as the training. As we indicated in the request, you could obviously send out untrained canvassers, probably not a good idea, not something that political organizations wish to do. The training of those canvassers is done specifically so that they do a better job of delivering that specific communication. It's again tied to a communication. And again, there's no utility, at least to the committee, of that training other than the delivery of those communications. It may be that the canvassers themselves get something out of it. It may be they're way better canvassers the next time for some other organization. But for the committee itself, it's not like they still have a computer left over. It's not like they have 50% of a staff member's time or some other durable good. All they have is the fact that those canvassers that they need to deliver those mechanisms are going forward. So that's why I think it fundamentally is a distinction from Correct the Record, and why the production versus distribution in practice ends up being a useful way that the commission can handle these issues going forward.
That's helpful. I have one last question, which is, I understand from your request that because Texas law doesn't allow you to use corporate or labor treasury funds for this, but you are using soft money, you're using funds that don't comply with the federal
Correct.
Or other source limits.
Yes.
Are there any limits from our perspective, assuming, say, you received a yes draft to this proposal? Are there limits on any source of funds from a federal perspective that could be used to pay for this canvas? Could a corporation itself use its own treasury funds to do a similar paid canvas in coordination with a federal candidate?
Yeah, I do not think that it happens to be that in Texas that you can't use corporate funds for that purpose. But I think if it were like a Virginia entity where you could, I think the answer would be the same.
Sure. Okay. So corporate, and the same would be true for union treasury funds.
Yes.
And okay, that's helpful. Those are the questions I had. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Any further questions or discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hello, Council. How are you?
Good to see you, Commissioner.
Always nice to see you. I'd like to give you an opportunity to explain something that I think there's a lot of interesting and knotty issues wrapped up in your request. It's interesting to me that you are arguing for a definition of communication that includes production costs, when, as I'm sure you're aware, there are other contexts where people have argued fairly vociferously that production costs shouldn't count, particularly in the internet context, for example, towards the cost of a communication. So, it's interesting. You know, one question that is I've been mulling over is whether we can have different views depending on different communications. That's it. For some communications, the production costs would count, and for other communications, the production costs wouldn't be considered part of the communication. So, well, let me stop there and see if you want to comment on that one.
Yeah. So I disagree a bit with the premise. I think in the context of internet communications, the production costs do count in the sense that if they are expended by a PAC, they are certainly reported by that PAC. And we would actually consider those to be a part of the communication cost. It's just that under 10921 and under the internet rulemaking, if that particular communication is not placed for a fee on the internet, it is not a coordinated communication. It doesn't mean that production costs are not part of that communication. It just means that it's not placed for a fee and therefore falls outside the definition of public communication.
Okay. Interesting.
I mean, in fact, I think otherwise it wouldn't, if those costs didn't count as part of the communication, I think then we'd be in the situation where we are a bit with pieces of draft day where you would actually count those costs as potentially under 10920B. So I think it actually has to be part of the communication for it to be, you know, within the ambit of 10921.
So it has to be, well, it seems like that might be a, you're trying to get to a particular result there. It has to be part of the communication because otherwise you're going to get nabbed by the next provision in the regulations.
Well, I mean, and I think that's the result piece of it. But if we look again at how, for example, if a, you know, 501c4 aired an electioneering communication, you would expect in the reports that are filed with the commission that they include both production and distribution costs. It explicitly says that. In fact, it refers to them as direct costs. When we report independent expenditures, whether it's a PAC, whether it's a non-committee, the questions that Sarah and I ask, and I think any lawyers in the regulated community, we always ask our clients, okay, do you have the production costs covered? Do you have the distribution costs covered? Do we forget any costs as part of that, right? We are always asking about production costs, distribution costs, and we consider those to be part of the communication costs when there is an obligation to report that, for example, as an electioneering communication or as an independent expenditure. And I think the principles we're articulating are very consistent with how those forms are constructed and how the EC rule is laid out.
Okay. How many people are you hoping to reach with this canvassing effort?
I don't know. I mean, I can go back and ask the client if they have a set goal, but that tends to get set as we get closer to.
How many pieces of identical literature are being printed?
I think we can see it would be more than 500.
You can see where I'm going with this.
No, absolutely, yes. We conceded that it would be more than 500.
So, and by the way, I haven't decided where I am on this question. But I like it when words mean what people think they mean. And I suppose the commission could come up with an interpretation that said, for the purposes of this regulation, blue is yellow. But I'm not sure that passes the arbitrary and capricious test because people have a sense, when Congress uses words, they are operating on the basis that people have some shared sense of what those words mean. So you're not contesting that this canvassing effort involves communication, plainly, right?
And we're arguing the opposite.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. You think it's all communication, but you are arguing that it's not a public communication, despite the fact that you are hoping to reach more than 500 people, you know, perhaps thousands of people, perhaps more than that. And in other parts of the statute and regulations, we define public as more than 500 substantially similar communications. So why are these more than 500 substantially similar communications? And we know they will be substantially similar because you just said people are going to be trained to deliver the message in exactly the way the client wants them. And you have certain printed materials, and obviously the printed materials will be the same. So why is this communication not a public communication?
So I think it's a great question. This obviously gets down to what we talked about initially as the threshold question of the matter. Is this a public communication or not? And, you know, the commission has always looked at the regulation here. And in defining what a public communication is, there are certain enumerated communications. And I think we all agree paid canvassing is not one of the enumerated communications. So then we have a catch-all at the end, which is general public political advertising. And so the question is whether this is general public political advertising. And where the commission has come out in past opinions, I think most recently in the 2022 text message AO involving Senator Hassan. And again, I'm gonna start with the dissenting opinion there, which I know you prefer. And the dissenters in that opinion said that these types of communications share two key characteristics. First, they are all communications for which a payment is required, and ours meets that test. Second, all general public political advertising communications rely on an intermediary to disseminate the message. This does not rely on an intermediary to disseminate the message.
You're not hiring a vendor to send these canvassers out?
A vendor is our agent, and our agent is not an intermediary. And we go through, I think, in detail in our advisory opinion request, what an intermediary is. And it's someone who's in between, right? It is someone who does not work for the voter. It's someone who doesn't work for the client. It is someone in between. And that's the definition to your point earlier, because I actually very much agree with you that words matter and we need to use words in the context in which they're used in the regulation consistently. And if you look at I think the only part that we really found where intermediary is defined is in the conduit provision. And there's an explicit exemption from definition of intermediary for a committee's agent that is used for that purpose. And the reason is that the basic dictionary definition, right, is that an intermediary is in go-between or a mediator. And so if general public political advertising requires there to be an intermediary, this just doesn't meet the test. Doesn't mean you can't rewrite your regulation, Congress can't rewrite the statute, but under the words of the regulation, it just doesn't meet the test.
That's a good argument. I have to tell you that when I read that, I was not sure that I agreed with your definition of intermediary, but I am going to study the subject further.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair. Couple. I think I want to zoom out again. Mm-hmm. This is interesting. I mean, any informed observer is aware of this long fight about what is and is not a public communication, that it comes out of the statute. This has been argued over for decades. Commissioner Weintraub knows the answers to the questions she's asking, as do all of us. This is it is a rich discussion going back some years. So I want to turn to the second question, where I think people are a little less committed. Let me ask it this way. We've talked a lot about the correct the record litigation. Has the DC Circuit adopted that argument?
So
my memory is it's on appeal and that we're talking about a district court opinion.
Yes, that is my read of the record. Obviously, I think it's public record that our firm has been involved, though Sarah and I personally have not been. My read of the record is that the only piece that went up to the DC Circuit was the standing issue. But that to the extent that this standard has been articulated, has been by the district court opinion in two different versions when it was up, and I think on remand in the last one.
And you're not here on behalf of Correct the Record.
I am not.
Okay. Well, let me just say as a preliminary matter, and maybe speaking for myself, that while I have the greatest respect for Judge Boasberg, who is an excellent lawyer and quite a bit smarter than me, district court opinions bind the parties. They don't oust regulation. Let me ask this question, because I've also been struggling with it. In response to the vice chairman's questions, you seem to suggest to me that let me back up. I mean, I hope that no one, you or anyone else, is under the impression that either of these drafts speak for the commission. These are drafts. They should not be taken as signaling mechanisms where all commissioners are. I'll leave it there. And so my question is, in response, you suggested that the rule that was being articulated was new to you or surprising or novel.
And so my question is just a basic question of statutory interpretation in terms of our authority, which is, are you familiar with the rule of law provision in the Act? I'll read it. So let me just find it. This is section 30108, the advisory opinion subsection. This is subsection B. Any rule of law not stated in this Act or in related chapters may be initially proposed by the commission only as a rule or regulation pursuant to procedures established in the relevant section. No opinion of advisory nature may be issued by the commission or any of its employees except in accordance with the provision of this section. And I'm going to ask ODC the same question because I'm not sure there's really a rich, I'm sure there is, but it's new to me, sort of how this provision gets interpreted. Do you have any concerns that the rule that's being articulated in these drafts is sufficiently novel as to raise concerns under the statutory provision?
I think as you describe it, yes. I mean, it is, I think to my conversation with the vice chair earlier, so much so that like seeing it in draft A came as a surprise to us, right? So at some level, that is a pretty good indicator of the novelty of it. And I think given what you read, I'd be interested in what OGC says as well here, because it's not a provision that I focused on, but it would seem to implicate that concern.
Let me ask OGC the same question then.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. It's not a question that we have considered, and we would like to take a look at that and consider it and get back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And since we're getting some time anyway, I'd be curious about that because I have had concerns in the back and forth that we are getting further over our skis than maybe is wise and then maybe the Congress intended this process to address. Related question actually for the Office of General Counsel. There's been some suggestion that the way forward here is to get a fuller description of proposed expenditures and go, I don't want to say go line by line, but take a more granular look at which expenditures the commission is going to consider, what sort of input costs and what's considered or not. Have we done that? It makes me nervous for a lot of prudential reasons, but do we have any experience of going line by line in terms of preferred expenditures and getting that granular in opinion?
I'll say that in our research on the subject, we didn't come across any commission precedent for drawing this line as to what a communication or an expenditure or where something falls in that spectrum. So, you know, we didn't review any material that suggested we had previously gone through it line by line like that.
Madam Chair, then just, I guess, a request to counsel, both ODC and for the requesters. I think we've gotten a little bit far afield here, and I'm not sure that anyone is really comfortable with the implications of what's being proposed. I would find it useful to have learned commentary on a way forward that's not going to overburden the advisory opinion process. Because I will say, and this is something that's been noted by a number of commissioners, especially in recent years, that the advisory opinion process is a really valuable tool. And I am nervous about it turning into essentially a pre-enforcement, frankly, pre-investigatory, you know, so fact-bound approach that we're essentially, one, unable to provide useful answers, and two, we so overburden the staff that our ability to meet the statutory deadline becomes questionable.
Any further discussion? Okay, so we have already been granted an extension. We'll leave it to OGC. Well, I think we can kind of leave it to OGC and the requester to figure out how many days and what time we need. But I think we've had some really good discussion here. I'm grateful that we received so many comments. It certainly helped. And we can certainly take more in as we figure this out in the way forward. Thank you all. All right. Well, Commissioner Broussard has a point of personal privilege. Or Mr. Knopf, did you have something Did I miss something? Okay. Commissioner Broussard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did request a point of personal privilege because this week I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge the passing of our longtime colleague, Pat Shepherd. Ms. Shepherd spent 32 years with the commission. I've worked with her for more than a decade. She was in the audit and RAD divisions, but more than 32 years at the agency, but nearly 40 years with the federal government. So that's a long time service that I think not just at the FEC, but the country as well, we're thankful and grateful for. And while she made significant contributions with the work at the agency, I think her larger legacy is that she was a support to her colleagues, and she lent a shoulder for people to lean on and an ear for listening. I personally remember that she was good friends with my paralegal, Deborah Rice. And so I would walk in on the two of them just talking away, and Pat would give me a very stern look that said, come back later. We're doing important work of the agency right now. But she always did everything with a good heart. And uniquely enough, she shares a birthday with Wanda Neal in our agency and also shares a wedding anniversary with Anita. Bailey. I was about to say the wrong name and everything. And one of the things that I learned just recently that Pat was looking forward to celebrating her 70th birthday and was in the process of planning that when she became ill. And while she will not be able to celebrate that birthday, I hope those that love and know her well will take that opportunity on that date to remember her and reflect on what a wonderful person she was. So I do want to say on behalf of the commission, I offer the sincerest condolences to Pat's family. I believe her daughter, Rachel, is in the audience. And so I'm sorry I'm not there to extend my condolences to her personally, but condolences to her family and both those at home and here at the FEC. So thank you, Madam Chair, for that opportunity.
So I'll be staff director. Get the title right. Thank you. Are there any management or administrative matters that need to be discussed today?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
Thank you. That concludes our open agenda. Thank you all. This meeting is adjourned.